It was a dark and stormy night, and four banks were gathered around a cauldron on a hilltop, plotting ways to fleece us. The Banking Royal Commission has produced villains that Shakespeare would be proud of. But through the drama run the real stories of people whose lives have been savaged by corporate misconduct. And we're all asking, will the Royal Commission stop that happening again? Michael Rodden has looked through days and weeks of testimony to tell the story of what he calls the best corporate blood sport in Australian history. He's a journalist with The Australian, and his brand new book is called The People Versus the Banks. Welcome to Life Matters, Michael.
G'day, Hilary. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Finance guru Alan Kohler said your book read like a true crime novel. Was that what it felt like, watching the commission play out?
Yeah, it took a while for it to actually sink in because, you know, when you're amongst it, and I was sitting in the federal court in a couple of cities across the country, you know, it was very procedural. It was very dry a lot of the times, but then there were moments of brilliance. But it is sort of, the lawyers working on the commission were painting this picture of how things went wrong. And during the course of their investigation, they assembled, you know, mountains of documents that they trawled through, and then they pieced together a picture of just, you know, something simple like a fee for no service scandal, but taking it right back to the start and where it came from, because obviously the Royal Commission has incredible powers to subpoena documents and gather little emails and text messages between executives. So it sort of allowed us to get this real sort of close inside look into the way that these organizations functioned and just where sort of like the personalities and the sort of the incentives went wrong. And it turned into, you know, just a real sort of, you know, mountains and mountains of calamitous drama, really.
Indeed. And it had all the true crime type characters, really, the bottom feeders, the middlemen, the puppet masters. Is there anyone that stands out in particular for you?
Yeah, well, I was just reading an article this morning. I tell the story of this company called Aboriginal Community Benefit Fund, and they're sort of this funeral insurance group run out of the Gold Coast by a white family with no ties to Aboriginal communities or people. They claim to have a few workers with Indigenous backgrounds, but they were going around the country, door-to-door sales, hawking these sort of largely useless funeral insurance policies, most of the time to people under the age of 18. You know, they had something like, 12,000 children signed up to their policies and, you know, earning millions of dollars from just, this rapacious sort of network. And the executive that sat in the witness stand for that company was this young guy called Bryn Jones, and he couldn't have been too much older than me, mid-30s, sort of looked like a bit of a boxer in a suit, and he just didn't seem to have any knowledge of what the company was doing. He was almost like a patsy. The actual founder of the company was either in Vanuatu or nowhere to be seen, and the whole sort of organizational structure was very murky and unclear. And so it was just this, this is sort of this Wild West sort of figure going around the country and just, you know, taking as much money out of the hands of people who really need to make every dollar count, really.
Indeed. It was a bit Wild West meets Rumpole in some moments. But then you've got the heroic figures too. Tell us about Rowena Orr QC. She not only had a nickname, but a catchphrase.
Yeah, exactly. Australia's favourite barrister really just set the tone for the whole endeavour. Rowena Orr, she's a fantastic lawyer, really sort of across the evidential brief. And there was a lot of theatre that went along with the Royal Commission because one of the points of the whole inquiry is to really capture the public's attention, to let them know that, yes, things are being done, your concerns are being heard, and we're acting upon it. These hapless bankers would be sitting in the stand and, you know, spending hours upon hours just trying to bloviate, dissemble, avoid questions, really just skirt around the issues. And they'd be, you know, dutifully sort of, you know, attempting to answer the question the best they could without implicating themselves or their business in sort of, you know, these questionable activities. And sooner or later, she would appear and say, you know, can I show you a document, executive? And up on the screen would flash this document that just would reveal them to have been lying for the last 3 hours. And it was sort of like a recurring theme, but it was just, you know, that the back row of the federal court was just, you know, in rapturous laughter every time it happened, because it was just so unexpected and they just had the goods and they could deliver every time.
Well, and if nothing else, the commission has brought us phrases like hapless bankers, which I don't think we'd really thought of before. It's quite a narrative arc, isn't it? Going from we don't need a royal commission to suddenly everyone thinks probably we do, except the banks and the government, to suddenly both the banks and the government calling for one. How did that happen?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, no one ever really thought that it would actually materialise in the end. You know, there was a lot of political posturing going back. You know, we had Senator Wacker Williams calling for a royal commission into white-collar crime, you know, for almost a decade. And that bubbled away in the background. There was a lot of sort of Senate committee investigations where they looked into sort of, you know, financial planning scandals and whatnot. But then around 2016, you know, the poor behaviour just kept on adding up. You know, we had Commonwealth Bank, you know, engaging in this sort of tawdry financial planning business, and then they got done on the life insurance unit, sort of denying legitimate life insurance claims for outdated definitions of heart attacks and whatnot. And then we had this big sort of rate rigging scandal where the key interest rate benchmark that's used to price, you know, billions of dollars of loans every day was being manipulated by not just one or two banks, but the whole, you know, sector. And it sort of, it triggered, you know, the Labor Party to sort of look at this a bit closer. And when the money laundering scandal broke with CBA, it was sort of just, it just seemed inevitable that by that point, because, you know, CBA was accused of sort of facilitating terrorism financing. And, you know, that's sort of, people don't really look lightly upon that. And then, you know, we have the situation where the Turnbull government at that time was just, you know, it had a wafer thin majority in the lower house and it was just at risk of losing a vote. So, you know, although that there was these really legitimate reasons to actually launch a royal commission, it was, in the end, it was just sort of, you know, political necessity because the government didn't want to lose a vote on the floor of the House.
What is startling too is that we'd had quite a lot of reviews into different parts of the financial services industry. How have they missed so much of what was going on?
It's a good question because there was, you know, two dozen really important reviews and reviews upon reviews over the last sort of decade. So after the global financial crisis, you know, we did take a closer look at the financial system as a whole and really sort of probe into different areas of it. And a lot of it was very useful. You know, we got things like the future of financial advice reforms out of that where, you know, planners have to act in customers' best interests. And, you know, a lot of other reforms where, you know, superannuation fees had to come down and, you know, products had to be made more simpler. But the issue was it never sort of went to misconduct. And they were never public procedures. You know, they were conducted by Treasury. There was, you know, it was very dense and very theoretical. And then what's more, once these reports were produced, either the government could ignore them or they could take them on. And the sort of the proposals that were put forward would just end up being watered down. You know, lobbyists would twist the arms of MPs to try and get their way. And there was just nothing that the public could really hang on to say that, like, yes, I understand that, you know, these people are being paid multi-millions of dollars every year and they're engaging in really unethical conduct. And I think that goes to the heart of it. You know, we don't so much mind as a country whether we're getting the best deal on a product, and our sort of our apathy about the banking sector shows that. Whereas we do get pissed off that, if I'm allowed to say that on radio.
Oh, no, we're in. Good heavens.
Yeah, apologies, listeners. But yeah, we do sort of, we don't like it when extremely powerful, well-paid people take us for granted as customers. And I think that was shown in just the level of sort of misconduct that was inquired into and sort of just the egregious behaviour, you know, taking money from dead people. It's a cracker of a story, you know, misleading the regulators over legal breaches and things like that. It's just not behaviour that you'd expect from someone who's on a multi-million dollar salary that's in charge of a very important financial institution that could, you know, if things went awry, really damage the economy as a whole.
We're chatting with Michael Rodden, who's a journalist with the Australian newspaper and author of a new book called The People Versus the Banks. And Michael, as you make clear in the book, it's not just about instances of misconduct, is it? Because if you squash one of them down, they pop up again because of the culture in these institutions. How easy is it to wrench a culture that's so profit-driven and so, you know, uncaring about the customer into a better line?
Yeah, it's a great question. And this is the problem, like we were just talking before about sort of, you know, reforming the system and changing laws and going through these processes. And we're seeing it right now with the actual recommendations that came out of the Hayne report. You know, there were 76, you know, pretty simple, you know, on the face of it, you couldn't really argue with the sort of the recommendations that were put forward. But, you know, just, you know, less than a week after it comes out, the mortgage broking industry lobbied the government effectively enough to ensure that $3 billion a year worth of useless trailing commissions would still continue to flow into their pockets. It's very hard to pass laws that will prevent any sort of misconduct. You know, we have laws regulating every aspect of society, but people still jaywalk. So in the end, the best thing that we can sort of hope for is to ensure that the culture in these organizations moves to a better footing. And that's the hardest thing to do because, you know, you can't really pass a law saying, you know, you have to treat your customers ethically and you have to come to work with the right sort of mindset. It's really difficult to get people to take that on personally and not just have it for themselves, but to share it with the rest of their workspace. But it was probably the most important point put forward by Hayne was just that the culture really needs to be set from the top and it needs to be thorough and it needs to be reliable. And when he made those comments in the final report, he named Ken Henry and Andrew Thorburn, the chairman and the chief executive of the National Australia Bank, as, you know, most likely not having the grandeur to set the culture right because they were just still bloviating, taking their time, not remediating customers and, you know, obsessing over little things that they didn't need to rather than the big picture. And so when they move out, they're in the process of leaving the bank now. And so time will tell if the culture at the organization changes. It can be very hard to change a culture. But on the other hand, it can be very easy to change a culture. You know, you just need the right sort of leader and you need to make sure what is, you know, where the line, you need to make it clear where the line is and what is not to be crossed and, you know, what line you should actually be working towards.
Well, and speaking of great leaders, there was when Kenneth Hayne handed over the final report, there was that excruciating photo op with Josh Frydenberg and Hayne refusing a handshake. Fast forward to last week's federal budget, how many of the recommendations have shown up in there with actual teeth?
Yeah, there's a lot of consultation going on at the moment. The government has been good in sort of progressing a couple of the simpler ones, you know, the less controversial ones. And I'm thinking here about, you know, giving ASIC greater penalties for corporate crimes, really. So the penalty regime that we used to have was really pathetic. You could engage in, you know, shocking behavior, and then the fine could just easily be factored into the cost of doing business. When we look at something like the rate rigging scandal that I was talking about before, a few banks settled that for about $25 million each, but Westpac decided to fight the case and try and prove its innocence. It sort of won and it sort of lost, but it ended up getting something like a $3 million fine. So, you know, 1/10 of the settlement that the other banks paid. So the government has been good at actually progressing those larger fines, giving ASIC greater power. It's provided much more funding to the regulators after, you know, 2 decades of, you know, underfunding. But then on the other hand, there are a lot of recommendations that will likely be pushed out into the never never. And one of those is about reforming the superannuation space. And it's going to be very difficult. And it's something so simple as just ensuring workers are only given one super fund in their life. So, and that super fund would follow them around to the job to job. It seems so it's inherently simple. It's a very easy concept and it should be done. But Labor is too beholden to the industry fund sector to sort of really get out on the front foot and make sure it does that in a way that protects workers' interest, and the Liberal government is too concerned about competition issues and you know, not sort of being able to work the system in a way that doesn't give the industry funds much more power than they already have because they're ideologically opposed to them. So there's all these politics that will still have to play out, and you know, time will tell how much of it gets passed. But you know, I guess I'm a little bit cynical about the ability for governments to you know, really sort of get on the front foot here.
I'm wondering too if, to an extent, we get the banks we deserve. There was an amazing moment where you write about the Commonwealth Bank shareholders saying, no, we don't want to have any clauses in the executive remuneration about people in community. We just want it to be about profit and maybe a bit of customer satisfaction. And also you've written elsewhere about how woeful we are as a consumer public about telling the difference between financial advice and marketing spin. Do we need to work on our financial literacy as a nation?
Yeah, it's a really big problem, and it's the financial system is so complex, and it's so sort of you know, difficult to wade through. It's like that by design. You know, the more complex the system is, the more confusing it is for customers, the easier it is for companies to sort of extract massive amounts of money from you without you realizing most of the time. And it was part of the reason why I wanted to write this book, was because I think that if we can't rely on governments to sort of design public policy in the way that will, you know, prevent this from happening, and if we can't rely on the companies themselves to act in our best interests, then it's really up to us to sort of vote with our feet and get engaged with the system as it is. And so I tried to explain it in a way that's engaging, that's fun, and that's really sort of educational, because one of the major problems that we have in this country is we are just very apathetic about our financial lives. And you know, I'm guilty of this completely. I had 7 superannuation accounts at one point.
7.
I had a string of odd jobs, and you know, was just incredibly lazy. And when you're young, you don't think you're going to live past 30. But you know, well, here I am. So it's about time I'm getting on board with that. But we are more likely to, you know, divorce our partners than we are to change our banks. And that means that they can take advantage of us. They take us for granted. We're charged huge fees compared to our global peers. And you look at these 4 companies that control 80% of the financial system, the big 4 banks, they're all intensely similar. Their mortgage rates are all within about, you know, 5 percentage points of one another. And there's just not a great difference between them. So if we actually took, you know, control of our financial lives and started shopping around, you know, ringing up the bank to complain about our mortgage rate, you know, we'd all get a better deal, and there wouldn't be these massive profits flowing to companies that don't have an interest in giving us back any service for it.
And I think we've all got an interest in making them wake up to that fact. Michael Rodden, thank you so much for coming onto Life Matters today.
Hilary, it's been great.
Michael Rodden, he's a journalist with The Australian. His new book is called The People versus the Banks. Is it a draw? Wait a few years, we'll find out.